I am Mary Virginia Micah from St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm here on sabbatical for a month, and I've been doing some editing of a personal journal that is called See You in the Morning. The title of this session is See You in the Morning, Embracing the Contraries, because I couldn't think of anything else to say when Jan came to me yesterday and said, what shall we call this? So we have 55 minutes, and I will begin. First of all, I thought you might be interested in seeing, speaking of contraries, you might be interested in seeing that this is the material I came up here with. It begins on page 167 and it concludes on page 436, double space computer printout. I thought I simply cannot deal with this bulk. So this is what I have now. It goes from page 1 to page 88. But it's small type and probably will go to about 125. So I figure my work this month has been done, and I'm very happy about it. I've told several of you the story of this journal that I'm going to read from, at least for part of the time we have together. But the rest of you may be interested in knowing that it's a personal journal I kept for 4 years between 1982 and 1986. I am a teacher by profession, a college teacher, and I decided that what was going to probably be my last full year professional sabbatical of my career, I would try to do what I had always wanted to do but was never quite sure I could do, and that was simply get away and write. I'm a member of a religious community that concentrates on teaching and nursing and social work and various other corporal works of mercy. And to be someone driven by the urge to write and not write letters to Congress and things like that, letters to my congresspersons, but to write poetry, filled me with a lot of guilt and still does sometimes. That's one of the contraries I've been working at. But anyway, I set off for this sabbatical, and I went to a small, very, very small town in central New York called Cazenovia. Some of you may know it. It's about 20 miles southeast of Syracuse, little Rip Van Winkle town. For the first time in my life, I lived alone, cooked for myself. And I lived above a mortuary, which may sound grim to you, but it was one of the smartest moves I've ever made in my life. I figured when I realized this place was available that the plumbing would be good, that the electricity would be good, that the place would be quiet, and it would be well kept, and indeed it was. I had a marvelous time those 6 months, and I wrote poetry. Some of you may have seen these little books that I'm supposed to say are in the bookstore. The poems that are letters to my landlady are the poems that I wrote during that time. And my landlady was one Eva Walsh, a staunch Lutheran who became a Catholic when she married John Walsh, whose family had owned this mortuary for a couple of generations. She was very much interested in Catholic nuns. The only Catholic nun she knew was a relative of her husband's, who, when she came to visit, would plunk herself down in the best chair in the living room and not lift a finger for the whole visit, would not even carry her dishes into the kitchen. So when Eva saw me scrubbing my floor and doing my shopping, it was a bit of a revelation to her. Anyway, I did that for 6 months and had a wonderful time. The story of my first night in the mortuary, I may tell you a little later. But anyway, I came back for the second half a year later thinking that I'd do the same thing. And I was confronted with a huge writer's block. That depressed me no end because all this wonderful time going to waste. And so after writing letters to everybody I knew, and realizing there were no more people to write to, I decided to do what I've always told my students to do, keep a journal. I had never done this before. So I started a letter to myself this snowy January day, and it turned out to be one of the closest friends of my life. I wrote in it off and on, decided I was going to pitch it out during those 6 months. I came back home, and eventually, for a celebration of our congregation, the 160th anniversary of our coming to the United to North America, I put out this series of chapbooks, one of which was excerpts from that journal, and I called it See You in the Morning. These excerpts were read on Minnesota Public Radio. Some of you may know that radio program. You may know Christina Sweet. She reads on Saturday mornings, and she got hold of this journal and read it. And I had such nice response from people that I decided I would take a look at the rest of it 4 years later. But at any rate, I started out with this journal, and I think what I'll do is just read from it, and you will see that it begins very low down the scale. It's dark night, pretty much. I'm just arriving in Cazenovia, a snowy January night, January 26, 1982, 46 Linklian Street. Can you all hear me all right? Okay. Who will ever read this? This gathering of a brain that takes in nothing much more today than the snow, strangely sunlit, whirling past one kitchen window, in a wing of one small house in a village with roots in the hills. Well, I will. On a day in my dotage, having outgrown the temptation to edit, I'll sit back and begin. I'll read straight on through to the end. And what will I say when I'm finished? For all that has been, thanks. Who knows? It's been a hard 2 weeks. When I piled in here January 13th, exhausted but full of hope and relief, I promised myself I'd be patient, take all the time my beaten up, overdriven spirit might need to find her own rhythms again. Since then, except for a few letters, I've poured myself into cleaning. Little Olive, my typewriter, sat through it all not saying a word, only watched as I laid about me with strong-smelling sponges avoiding her eye. She must have known I couldn't set down my clothes or food on all that grime. This was a bachelor apartment, this second one that I rented. The first one had been sold. No more mortuary. Variants of the definition of clean would read like a world atlas. Where I come from, its meaning extends to even the floor of the shower. Though there were moments when I'd have accepted a narrower regional definition quickly enough, had I been able to keep on showering on the outside edges of my feet. But when finally that floor lay white behind me, there remained nothing more heroic to attack than my blank mind. So I picked up my crosswords. Between crosswords, I thought, I can catch at ideas. But nothing came. I couldn't even begin. I still can't. But today I'll at least go on with this letter. To whom, I don't know. Even that I can't say. This morning after Mass, I walked up Linklian Street for about 6 blocks, exploring this new space, until I was turned back by an unfriendly barking beyond the next hedge. I had no wish to tangle, so retraced my steps through 3 inches of fresh snow that had fallen again last night. We get a new batch almost every night, and every morning I push aside the limp lace curtains on the back door to check how it looks on my steps and along the small path they've carved for me over no sidewalk at all. Some days, after a bit of afternoon sun, I picture what that path will feel like in spring mud. As it is now, I'm wearing mink-oiled knee boots with my cord stuffed in, two pair of socks, cotton, then wool, according to Bean. Duofold underwear, turtleneck, and a ski sweater someone abandoned because it didn't match her colors that year. Plus my down jacket. It's a treat in itself to go along in these warm, light clothes. I'm eating well, sleeping well, eating well too. Last night I baked a fresh Idaho trout, the second of identical twins I found at the supermarket. I'd fried the first one earlier with a great pileup of dishes and flowery sex and a broadcast of crumbs to show for it. I feel kindly watched by my cookbooks. My only disaster so far was a heavy glob of curdle that gathered the minute I poured hot milk into an apple cider mix, don't ask me why. And with every success, I get braver. I rise serene now to chicken livers sautéed with onions and squash and cheese casseroles. I'd travel out even farther if I were laying in supplies for more than 6 months. I do wonder, though, whether I'm being decadent in paying such heed to my taste buds. They don't seem the most edifying concern for a woman of the cloth, if that's who I am. But whoever dips into my casserole seems to appreciate what she spoons up. I certainly do. To lift off the cover of a tomatoey mixture and let it bubble up mushroom and basil under my nose does a lot to counteract the many subtle efforts a part of me makes to punish myself for all those worst of my shortcomings, those I can neither name nor find a shape for. Terrible brown ghosts with sinews like bedsprings. January 27th. Sometimes I feel I'm tunneling through. But when I try to expedite the process, as I did this morning, waking before light, I find I can't get hold of any meaning at all, my own or the world's. I may be living like a hermit, but I pray when I pray in a vacuum. The language of prayer, like the language of Scripture, seems lifeless and false to my present experience, worn out or inadequate to provide words for what's going on in the deepest part of my being. Sometimes I wonder whether, for all these years, I haven't been delighting merely in scriptural metaphor, rather than living the reality of faith. But what is faith? What goes when it goes? What remains? Where is the language that binds together the life of the spirit and my spirit? In this makeshift little apartment, cut off from all but essential relationships, I'm trying to live quietly with myself and listen, hoping to hear that new language, hoping to be forgiven if my inaction in the face of darkness and silence is sloth. It isn't that I believe God is dead, but God is so silent, has been for so long, and is so hidden. I take it as a sign I must watch in other places or simply tend my small fires until the end. I wonder what will become of me, the question in every mind, I suppose, behind every pair of eyes. Such a long period of indirection this has been. Easing me toward what? Patience and hope are fragile threads, but these are all I have to tell me I'm living. And it is my struggle to keep afloat in the inner dark that makes the pressures from the outside often almost unbearable. I hadn't intended to be writing like this, but I discovered very soon that I needed someone to talk to, someone I could trust, and it turned out here to be myself. I deliberately, and once I discovered that there was a great deal inside of me that needed to be said, I deliberately avoided reading books about people who have gone through similar kinds of periods in their lives, because I wanted very much to get at this, whatever it was, in my own terms. And I finally came to refer affectionately to my journal as my cheap couch. So it continues. It isn't all gloomy, so take heart. But I'll read you another passage in which I'm still doing this kind of questioning. January 28th. Why are my memories of pain so much sharper than my memories of joy? I know there have been happy periods in my life. I know as soon as I consciously set about listing them, countless people who have befriended, admired, trusted me, perhaps more than they should, I'm quite capable of betrayal. Yet what continues to loom, swell, pour over me are great undulations of sorrow. Why? And what for? I think of the braidings of sorrow. My mother, together with her own mother and seven brothers and sisters, was left to fend for a livelihood when their unpredictable father headed out early in life to live, as nearly as I can figure out, deep in the Florida Everglades. My mother, I suppose, was always conscious of this. Her deep-set eyes spoke more pain than her mouth ever did. My grandmother, who visited us in the summer, would sit looking out over the lake for hours at a time while we played in the sand, or would sit alone on the beach, her small rounded back turned on the life in the cottage behind her. I can still see her down the distance from the house to the lake, brooding motionless through what seemed then whole afternoons. I would say to my mother, "What's Grandma doing?" "She's all right," my mother would say. "She's just thinking." Of what? Of the grace she'd left behind in Vienna, the woods and the waltzes, when she followed that draft-dodging husband to America? Of the letter she'd had to read years later, after her own mother was found dead in a ditch one morning outside her village? Or of the hard justice of her merciful God, whom she prayed to and preached at her angry children with no questions allowed? I remember we would visit her at Christmas and again at the end of the Lenten fast. Grandma, in her black fur coat and purple felt hat, insisted on staying for all three masses at Christmas. The purple hat would bow lower and lower over her hands as the masses went on, but never so low she couldn't see when you sank back to rest your small rear on the edge of the seat for a minute. Yet she loved us, like someone who can find no other escape. She filled us with goodies and gathered us against her fresh apron, kissed and hugged us, and in a mixture of English and Bohemian I can still hear, begged us all to sit down and visit together. But to the end, unable to lay eyes on, much less forgive, the husband who came back only once. Yet is that the truth? Is there any way I can know how far, as she lay dying, she may have been able to penetrate beyond that deepest sorrow of all, the inability to forgive? And will I be able to open my arms to my whole grief and all it has made of me by the end? February 12th. The dogs here know what they're doing. They make their mark. Perhaps because it's winter and cold, they seem more in evidence than the cats. Katie, the collie shepherd custodian of this house, stands almost nose to nose with me when she puts her front paws on my chest. This she does, and me still a stranger, as the first step in her plan. She has it in mind to come in my door and cross over my carpet to the door she knows opens into her house and her carpet and the silent companionship of the silky cat Jet, who can curl into an absolute nap wherever the sun at the moment is warming the floor. But when that crucial door is bolted from the other side, I'm no help to Katie. I tried yesterday to shove her home through my closet, where there's another door hooked only on my side. But she was scared of those empty sleeves and pants legs and the boots darkly lined up. She stiffened and sat solidly down. So I had to push her outside again into the cold, feeling a big brute myself, as she meant to suggest with a swipe or two of her long paw down the storm door now closed against her. I apologized deeply and tried to explain hooks and bolts, but she slunk down the steps, tail drooping, with a backward look of reproach. This morning she left square in my path, an obvious sign of her displeasure. Yet she's quick to forget, and in the full swing of daily street life she makes a fine escort, even when smelly, in need of a bath. She drew me into the scene the first morning I came around the corner headed for Mass. She had curled against a sunny snowdrift where she could keep an eye on the house and sidewalks, but could also, when certain lowbrow trucks came rocking out, throw herself valiantly out into the street to chew up the tires, though she knows such valor is naughty. Well, one glimpse of me that morning and she was on her feet, nose forward, ears up, ready. "Just going over to church," I explained, and, since she obviously intended to lead, pointed the way. She stepped along high, long, delicate legs, the tail flinging right and left freely. She's not a Catholic dog, as far as I know. Entertains no particular expectation of Sundays. But before we'd gone half a block, I realized she and I were the center of a community of half a dozen dogs of every persuasion under the sun. A black and white terrier about a third Katie's size, who lured her into a game of bite leg then tail, then tore off yapping over the snow. Then a thick sheepdog snuffling the drifts with a snout the shape of a shoebox. Then a black lab, all paws and loose joints. Then a golden retriever puppy. And one German police with a red bandana knotted cowboy fashion around his bristly neck. Thus we paraded up Nickerson, they rubbing and twisting, and I, suddenly some kind of latter-day shepherd without rod or staff, reduced to easing along as best I could, on the current of this self-confident flock. All but Katie dropped off, however, at favorite garages and alleyways. Only Katie saw me to the door of the church, and only Katie was back in her spot against the snowdrift to welcome me home. February 22. I'm not going on with this journal. Yesterday, because I felt up to everything, and because I've often observed to my students that your first thought isn't necessarily your best, I began to edit here and there among generally muddy passages. I got through about 15 pages before I heard myself sigh and then yawn, the way you do when you're not so much tired as bored. That was that. I retyped one or two pages I'd thoroughly messed up, and then with a little snort that meant whatever it meant, stacked my journal in the far corner of my desk and turned to something else. February 25th. Well, there's too much breathing from the far reaches of my desk. I'm back, though I don't know for how long. March 29th. Yesterday I turned over my typewriter ribbon and I read 32 pages to Agnes. This morning, not a soul in sight. Katie stood on the porch, and with her nose lifted, barked 3 times to the east, 5 or 6 to the south, then 3 more to the west. 3 blackbirds together flew over the barn. These are signs and omens Odysseus would have rejoiced in. Time to set out. Where, of course, is the question. Not a goal in sight. I spent a lot of the time when I wasn't at my typewriter helping a woman of 80 years old raked the gravel that the snowplows had deposited on her tulip bed out of the garden. And that's my wonderful friend, Grace. But this is nearing the end of that period. This is May 5th. Walking to church in the fresh coolness of this morning, I found myself repeating, "Darkness is not dark to you. Darkness and light are the same." If so, let it be. Let the Lord love us exiles and redeem us. 2 summers ago, I sang with a group of sisters from all over the country about the potter and the clay. And for all I knew myself a very empty, very clay pot, I felt the sweet, sure conviction that the potter had chosen even my clay with love, and I could be content. Where that vivid sense of being touched, contained in, and shaped by 2 loving hands came from, I can't explain, but there it was. Why these blessed reassurances, pure gift, don't remain with me, I also don't know. When the dark closes in again, all light is forgotten, and in my frantic effort to sort out a life neither all good nor all bad, and lived out among others of the same caste, I grope like one lost. Today I see that wherever I'm going, I won't get there alone, nor by a route comprehensible to me, except perhaps at the far end, where I expect I will see I was indeed both darkness and light, yet nothing at all except by the mercy of God. May 18th. Instead of saying good night to her children, Mary Beth says, "See you in the morning." June 24th. I was going to work soberly today, pack tomorrow and clean Saturday. But after Mass, I had to turn down toward the creek. A very short walk was my thought. But it was a while before I could emerge from the sense of God's presence keeping me in this spot to listen with the dragonflies and the unfolding water lilies to the sounds of morning beyond the woods. A delivery truck, workmen hammering on a new roof, a plane slanting north. 1,000 exhortations to the village crowded to be put into sentences, reminders that now I was leaving, they'd have to take care of the shadows and the air and the damp roots bumping up through the mud. I looked into the pond and along the twist of wild grape for images to help me, but none came, only this crowding loveliness of early summer, and me called to acknowledge it. Praise. You have to take time to praise. I walked out on the cement wall backing the locks where I could look downstream between the willows and watch the leaves, twigs, ripples, bubbles, silk lines of water braiding along around the bend and out of sight. I looked up to see a teenage fellow passing, gaunt as a ghost, the sleeves of his t-shirt loose and flapping around the sticks of his upper arms, and smiled at him. "It's beautiful looking downstream today," I said. He smiled shyly and nodded, slowed for a bit, and then walked on. As I watched the knobs of his knees and his flopping sneaks, I couldn't help wondering what downstream held for him. I came on him later, sitting himself and gazing out at a place where the water branches, and we talked for a few minutes. What I wanted to do was give his hand a good squeeze and sit there with him for a while. But I didn't know how to do it. He was gentle, reticent, a well-bred Easterner. That, with his obvious illness, could make my Midwestern approach overwhelming. So I went on home, putting him silently on my list. June 26th. Grace just called and wants to meet me for Mass tomorrow morning. We decided she'll wear her Episcopalian hat or not, just as she feels. I'll talk to Eva once more, and Mary Beth, and take my several loads of borrowed blessings back over to Ernie in Marilyn's attic. Then Peg will pick me up, because it will be time. And that was the end of that journal. That's excerpts from the first 160 pages. So I went on and on and on for 4 years, if you can imagine. So does anybody want to say anything? I suppose some of you keep journals, don't you?
Yeah.
You find it's a friend?
Yeah,
I do. Yeah. Yeah, huh? Keeps us off the streets too, doesn't it? Yes. When I came here 3 weeks ago, I thought I can't begin to get into this load of stuff. But once I did and found passages that really still hold me that I had forgotten, I'm glad I kept it. I don't know where it'll go once I go, but then I'm not going to worry about that. But I begin to see a design in my life and to understand my own reactions to things a lot better. And I suppose when you keep a journal, you have a strong enough sense of ego to be able to laugh at your own jokes and, you know, and experiment with how well can I put that dog, Katie, into words. She used to come, she was such a pest. This the second time I lived out there, I lived in a wing of a smallish house, but it was one of those historically preserved houses. And there were doors that opened into the next apartment, but they were more or less locked. But Katie had apparently been great friends with the bachelor who lived there before me. And she was smelly at times, and a great big collie shepherd. But she would scratch on that door until I let her in, and then she'd come in, and there was a spot on the rug which was none too clean in the first place, but there was a long spot that was obviously Katie. And she would go to that place, whether I had come back from a trip and had my stuff all around, she'd push it aside and lie right on that spot. Well, she really was wonderful.
Will you tell us about the moisturizer? Oh,
yes, I will. I had been living I went out to Casanova, not knowing where I was going to live for the 6 months. This was the first time I went out. But I did make a friend out there who had a small farm outside of town, and she said, I drive into town every day. She taught at Syracuse University, and she said, you can live with me until you find a place. So I did. But I was up and down the streets of this little town in an occupation quite strange to me. Have you got a place where I can live? Have you got a place where I can live? I sober and industrious and all those things, single and all the rest of it. Have no designs on anything except to get a little space. Well, somebody told me about Eva. And one Sunday morning after Mass, I walked down to Eva's place. And there was this good-looking, sturdy, reddish-blonde woman standing, leaning with one elbow on a long gray station wagon. It looked like a station wagon, but I realized later that it was the hearse. So I went up to her and I said, "Are you Eva?" "Yes," she said, looked me up and down. And remember, this is the Eva whose aunt-in-law sat in the chair and made people wait on her. And so I told her who I was. "Oh," she said. And she said, "Well, I've got this place upstairs." She lived in a lovely house across the driveway from the mortuary. The mortuary, incidentally, on the outside looked like a very gracious white wooden house, two stories with a broad porch, and it was a lovely place. But she said, "I've got that apartment upstairs where my overflow family sleeps in the summertime when they come to visit me. Casanova is a resort town. There's nothing much up there," she said, and then she gave me another look, and she said, "All right, you can have it." So I moved in. Her husband had died, as I found out, 6 weeks before I came, very suddenly. And he was the kind of man who took care of everything himself. He wasn't going to worry his wife about the business, though she certainly stood as hostess at the door of the funeral parlor when there were wakes and so on. So she knew something about the business. But she didn't know much of anything, really. And when he died very suddenly, she was left with this on her hands. And it was into that kind of mess in her life that I appeared. The first night I got there was the night of her first wake. It was a double wake. A husband and wife had been killed in an automobile accident, leaving a family of about four or five young children. And she had this thing on her mind. But she said to me, "Go on upstairs and everything's there." So I went up, but found that she had forgotten to give me the dishes. We had arranged that she would give me dishes. So knowing what her situation was, I decided to forget the dishes, and I had brought with me from Mary Beth's house a cold chicken leg and a few crackers and some milk in a peanut butter jar. And I looked in the cupboards. There was absolutely nothing there except one of those big, massive cigarette holders that they have in mortuaries. You know, you lift it up and it weighs about 6 tons. Ashtrays, I mean. So I ate my chicken leg out of that, chicken leg and crackers, and drank my milk out of the peanut butter jar and went into the living room where there was a card, very much like Gertrude's furnishings, a card table and a little table. It looked like the kind of table my dad used to clean fish on, but I said to myself, that'll be great for my typewriter, and a folding chair from the mortuary downstairs. And I didn't have a wastebasket, Gertrude. I had to use grocery bags, but I got along just fine. Anyway, I was sitting in there. All of a sudden, about 9 o'clock, I realized that things were quieting down downstairs. And up the back stairs comes Eva, wants to know how everything is. And I said, "It's just fine. now, maybe tomorrow I can get some dishes." "Oh," she said, "I forgot the dishes. We'll go right over and get them." This was 9 o'clock at night. I said, "Well, I can wait till morning." "No, no, no, you'll have to have something for breakfast." So we went out the door, the front door of the mortuary this time, down those gracious steps. And the front lights were on, but the rest of the village was dark. Walked over to her house and went to her kitchen. She flung open the kitchen cupboards, pulled out two trays, and on one she piled pans and frying pans and measuring cup and that sort of stuff, a couple of pie tins. And on the other, she began putting china, four plates, four saucers, four cups, four sauce dishes, four soup bowls. I said, "Oh, Eva, I'm all by myself. You're going to have company," she said, and she kept piling this stuff on. "Now let's go," says she. So out we go, a strange procession. Me first with my pans on the tray, she following me with this china. We got to the front step, and I got up safely, but she tripped, and down she went with a great resounding crash all through the town. I thought, "Oh, Lord, what's this going to say about our relationship?" She got up and dusted herself off, and she said, "I'll go get the dustpan." So she goes back to the garage, gets the dustpan, brings it out, plus a big tin dustbin, gathers it up, throws it in with another great clatter, and said, all right, now we'll go back for more dishes. So back we went and repeated the performance, and this time we got the stuff upstairs safely. The set was broken, to say the least. I had a few odd cups here and there, but that was Eva all the way through. She was most kind to me. And we became very close friends. And the landlady of this little book is Eva. The first, I never had paid rent before. You know, my rent was always paid for me. So I had to be told that the rent was due on a certain day, not just any old time I chose to write the check. So second time around, I sent this poem along with her, with the check. Letter to my landlady. Dear, dear Eva, in your house everything works. Hot runs hot and cold runs cold, and what needs to go down goes directly down. You never hesitate. You told me there's nothing much up here, but what about these windows? I count 14, all of them open, close, and lock, and the screens slide up and down on 14 different views of trees, roofs with chimneys smoking, paths crisscrossing to school, Marianne's fence and clothespin bag, and at 1:15 the mailman's cap turning. The bed accommodates me like the countryside this village sleeps in, as do 29 hooks per closet. Every room has its big closet. And I cannot believe your smooth springing ironing board. True, your knives are what you said, dull, terrible, terrible knives. But I see you laugh through what you can't cut. Nor do the cups match any of the saucers. Yet, vision imbalanced myself, I stand to admire your various resources, like the one mirror giving me only the top half, and the other one was on the floor in the closet. Well, the full picture of me lording around your abundant house, that's more than you could take in all at once anyway. So here's the rant again. I'll read you a 20 to 4. I'd like to read you some from the other two, the other little books. Here's one that's a sort of silly one. I was fool enough at that point to bring my white slacks. This was a long time ago when people wore tight-fitting slacks. And there were cats all around the place. I say of this poem that it's a 20th century version of the Sacrament of Reconciliation. You can judge for yourselves. It's called Rinse O' White. Yes. Rings a bell for most of you, not you in the back. Anyway, Rinso was a laundry soap, only this is spelled Rinse O White. When it says right here on the label, do not bleach, what are you supposed to do, for God's sake, about the spots? Beer and salad dressing, and look at all that cat scat. What happens when you bleach them anyway, these polyester, white to begin with, stretch to your shape pants you were a fool to buy in the first place? Well, what? Do they end all yellow, rot from the inside out, slow burn up the cuff or in the pockets? If so, then better go with the spots. Start with scrub as much as possible between your heavy-duty, no-bleach, raw knuckles, imitating the ritual of washboards, and before that, beating until clean on ancient rocks. And then when this doesn't work, simply kneel down in maybe even the mud in pure acknowledgement to the manufacturer that as far as his, her whites are concerned, you're out beyond your depth. I'd like to read one from this little book. This little book is the text of a performance that we gave when the gathering of our sesquicentennial week was beginning down in St. Louis. There was a dancer and a pianist and myself reading, and this is the text. And she danced in and out, and we had music in and out, and the reading. But here is a poem that here it is. Recipes. I'll tell you a little story about this. It's such a strange story, I think. I live with a group of 14 other women, and those of you who are the heads of your own household can imagine what that's like. The rest of you will just have to take it on faith that sometimes it can get a little thick. But we try. I remember one Sunday morning walking into the kitchen, and two of the sisters were fixing brunch. We do this in turns. And I came into the kitchen feeling just fine, and for reasons I do not honestly remember, I left that kitchen in a rage. Something had crossed my path. Whatever it was, I got out of there feeling awful, Sunday at that, and I was just furious. So I walked into the living room where we have a wall of cupboards where each of us has a little place to keep her stuff. I almost blindly opened mine, pulled out a batch of my recipes, and I'm no great cook, but pulled out these recipes, went down to the laundry where we keep our typewriter, and began typing out some of these recipes, retyping them. And as I typed, life in the cottage behind her. I can still see her down the distance from the house to the lake, brooding motionless through what seemed then whole afternoons. I would say to my mother, "What's Grandma doing?" "She's all right," my mother would say. "She's just thinking." Of what? Of the grace she'd left behind in Vienna, the woods and the waltzes, when she followed that draft-dodging husband to America? Of the letter she'd had to read years later, after her own mother was found dead in a ditch one morning outside her village? Or of the hard justice of her merciful God, whom she prayed to and preached at her angry children with no questions allowed? I remember we would visit her at Christmas and again at the end of the Lenten fast. Grandma, in her black fur coat and purple felt hat, insisted on staying for all three masses at Christmas. The purple hat would bow lower and lower over her hands as the masses went on, but never so low she couldn't see when you sank back to rest your small rear on the edge of the seat for a minute. Yet she loved us, like someone who can find no other escape. She filled us with goodies and gathered us against her fresh apron, kissed and hugged us, and in a mixture of English and Bohemian I can still hear, begged us all to sit down and visit together. But to the end, unable to lay eyes on, much less forgive, the husband who came back only once. Yet is that the truth? Is there any way I can know how far, as she lay dying, she may have been able to penetrate beyond that deepest sorrow of all, the inability to forgive? And will I be able to open my arms to my whole grief and all it has made of me by the end? February 12th. The dogs here know what they're doing. They make their mark. Perhaps because it's winter and cold, they seem more in evidence than the cats. Katie, The collie shepherd, custodian of this house, stands almost nose to nose with me when she puts her front paws on my chest. This she does, and me still a stranger, as the first step in her plan. She has it in mind to come in my door and cross over my carpet to the door she knows opens into her house and her carpet and the silent companionship of the silky cat Jet, who can curl into an absolute nap wherever the sun at the moment is warming the floor. But when that crucial door is bolted from the other side, I'm no help to Katie. I tried yesterday to shove her home through my closet, where there's another door hooked only on my side. But she was scared of those empty sleeves and pants legs and the boots darkly lined up. She stiffened and sat solidly down. So I had to push her outside again into the cold, feeling a big brute myself, as she meant to suggest with a swipe or two of her long paw down the storm door now closed against her. I apologized deeply and tried to explain hooks and bolts, but she slunk down the steps, tail drooping, with a backward look of reproach. This morning she left square in my path, an obvious sign of her displeasure. Yet she's quick to forget, and in the full swing of daily street life she makes a fine escort, even when smelly, in need of a bath. She drew me into the scene the first morning I came around the corner headed for Mass. She had curled against a sunny snowdrift where she could keep an eye on the house and sidewalks, but could also, when certain lowbrow trucks came rocking out, throw herself valiantly out into the street to chew up the tires, though she knows such valor is naughty. Well, one glimpse of me that morning, and she was on her feet, nose forward, ears up, ready. "Just going over to church," I explained, and, since she obviously intended to lead, pointed the way. She stepped along high, long, delicate legs, the tail flinging right and left freely. She's not a Catholic dog, as far as I know. Entertains no particular expectation of Sundays. But before we'd gone half a block, I realized she and I were the center of a community of half a dozen dogs of every persuasion under the sun. A black and white terrier about a third Katie's size, who lured her into a game of bite leg then tail, then tore off yapping over the snow. Then a thick sheepdog snuffling the drifts with a snout the shape of a shoebox. Then a black lab all paws and loose joints. Then a golden retriever puppy, and one German police with a red bandana knotted cowboy fashion around his bristly neck. Thus we paraded up Nickerson, they rubbing and twisting, and I suddenly some kind of latter-day shepherd without rod or staff, reduced to easing along as best I could on the current of this self-confident flock. All but Katie dropped off, however, at favorite garages and alleyways. Only Katie saw me to the door of the church, and only Katie was back in her spot against the snowdrift to welcome me home. February 22. I'm not going on with this journal. Yesterday, because I felt up to everything, and because I've often observed to my students that your first thought isn't necessarily your best, I began to edit here and there among generally muddy passages. I got through about 15 pages before I heard myself sigh and then yawn, the way you do when you're not so much tired as bored. That was that. I retyped one or two pages I'd thoroughly messed up, and then with a little snort that meant whatever it meant, stacked my journal in the far corner of my desk and turned to something else. February 25th. Well, there's too much breathing from the far reaches of my desk. I'm back, though I don't know for how long. March 29th. Yesterday I turned over my typewriter ribbon and I read 32 pages to Agnes. This morning, not a soul in sight. Katie stood on the porch and with her nose lifted, barked 3 times to the east, 5 or 6 to the south, then 3 more to the west. 3 blackbirds together flew over the barn. These are signs and omens Odysseus would have rejoiced in. Time to set out. Where, of course, is the question? Not a goal in sight. I spent a lot of the time when I wasn't at my typewriter helping a woman of 80 years old rake the gravel that the snowplows had deposited on her tulip bed out of the garden. And that's my wonderful friend, Grace. But this is nearing the end of that period. This is May 5th. Walking to church in the fresh coolness of this morning, I found myself repeating, "Darkness is not dark to you. Darkness and light are the same." If so, let it be. Let the Lord love us exiles and redeem us. 2 summers ago, I sang with a group of sisters from all over the country about the potter and the clay. And for all I knew myself a very empty, very clay pot, I felt the sweet, sure conviction that the potter had chosen even my clay with love, and I could be content. Where that vivid sense of being touched, contained in, and shaped by 2 loving hands came from, I can't explain, but there it was. Why these blessed reassurances, pure gift, don't remain with me, I also don't know. When the dark closes in again, all light is forgotten, and in my frantic effort to sort out a life neither all good nor all bad, and lived out among others of the same caste, I grope like one lost. Today I see that wherever I'm going, I won't get there alone, nor by a route comprehensible to me, except perhaps at the far end, where I expect I will see I was indeed both darkness and light, yet nothing at all, except by the mercy of God. May 18th. Instead of saying good night to her children, Mary Beth says, "See you in the morning." June 24th. I was going to work soberly today, pack tomorrow and clean Saturday. But after Mass, I had to turn down toward the creek. A very short walk was my thought. But it was a while before I could emerge from the sense of God's presence keeping me in this spot to listen with the dragonflies and the unfolding water lilies to the sounds of morning beyond the woods. A delivery truck, workmen hammering on a new roof, a plane slanting north. 1,000 exhortations to the village crowded to be put into sentences. Reminders that now I was leaving, they'd have to take care of the shadows and the air and the damp roots bumping up through the mud. I looked into the pond and along the twist of wild grape for images to help me, but none came. Only this crowding loveliness of early summer, and me called to acknowledge it. Praise. You have to take time to praise. I walked out on the cement wall backing the locks where I could look downstream between the willows and watch the leaves, twigs, ripples, bubbles, silk lines of water braiding along around the bend and out of sight. I looked up to see a teenage fellow passing, gaunt as a ghost, the sleeves of his t-shirt loose and flapping around the sticks of his upper arms, and smiled at him. "It's beautiful looking downstream today," I said. He smiled shyly and nodded, slowed for a bit, and then walked on. As I watched the knobs of his knees and his flopping sneaks, I couldn't help wondering what downstream held for him. I came on him later, sitting himself and gazing out at a place where the water branches, and we talked for a few minutes. What I wanted to do was give his hand a good squeeze and sit there with him for a while. But I didn't know how to do it. He was gentle, reticent, a well-bred Easterner. That, with his obvious illness, could make my Midwestern approach overwhelming. So I went on home, putting him silently on my list. June 26th. Grace just called and wants to meet me for Mass tomorrow morning. We decided she'll wear her Episcopalian hat or not, just as she feels. I'll talk to Eva once more, and Mary Beth, and take my several loads of borrowed blessings back over to Ernie in Marilyn's attic. Then Peg will pick me up, because it will be time. And that was the end of that journal. That's excerpts from the first 160 pages. So I went on and on and on for 4 years, if you can imagine. So does anybody want to say anything? I suppose some of you keep journals, don't you?
Yeah.
You find it's a friend?
Very good.
Uh-huh. It keeps us off the streets, too, doesn't it? Yes.
I think reading it over is the interesting part.
I really, when I came here 3 weeks ago, I thought, I can't begin to get into this load of stuff. But once I did and found passages that really still hold me, that I had forgotten, I'm glad I kept it. I don't know where it'll go once I go, but then I'm not going to worry about that. But I begin to see a design in my life and to understand my own reactions to things a lot better. Thank you very, very much.